Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
It's the Midday 180 served up by Wendy's here on 104.5 The Zone. We are broadcasting live from Nissan Stadium, East Side, club level, to Battle the Badges, Blood Drive. We are thrilled to be here every year with 104.5 The Zone. Wake Up Zone was here earlier. We're here until 2. 3HL will be here until 6 p.m. Great day supporting a great cause. Come out, give blood. You're on your lunch break. Looks like the wait's not too long right now. There are some people waiting, but they do a good job. Paul, as you mentioned before, they're very efficient at getting people through. You can give blood, you can get out of here and donate to a great cause because there is a blood shortage out there. So every little bit counts, every little bit helps.
Come find out if you have blood that saves babies, like I do.
Yeah, that's what Paul does. Maybe John Feinstein has baby-saving blood also. He's of the Washington Post. He joins us now. John, can your blood save babies as well?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question, Chad. I've donated blood through the years, but nobody ever told me that I did.
You'd know. Or didn't. You'd know. We're a special breed. We have
special breed, Paul.
Yeah, tiny, tiny babies.
And you guys must do this every year on Monday, because it seems like I'm on every year as you're doing it.
Absolutely, yeah. Monday in July every year, so you're always on with us, John. I want to start with Coco Gauff. She was eliminated from Wimbledon earlier this morning by Simone Halep, but a great run for her. And I found myself truly captivated by her and by her match on Friday. I know a lot of Americans probably felt the same way. I find myself getting excited again about the prospects of a very young phenom and what could possibly happen with them in the future.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we had an American teenage phenom. It's been a long time since we've had an American man who was a contender in any way. But we have not. It used to be. It seemed like Chrissy Evert led to Andrea Jaeger. Andrea Jaeger led to the Williams sisters. And then, boom, it kind of stopped. You had Americans who had their moments. Lindsay Davenport won 3 majors. She was a heck of a player. Mary Jo Fernandez was a phenom. I remember covering her at the French Open in 1985, but she was overshadowed a little bit by someone named Steffi Graf, as it turned out. But yeah, it's cool. It's also kind of cool that this was a young player who was inspired by the Williams sisters and wanted to become a player like them and ends up beating Venus Williams in her first match at Wimbledon and showed remarkable poise, as you pointed out, Chad, on Friday. It's interesting to that Venus and Serena clearly inspired a group of young African-American women to get into the sport. I mean, we've got Sloane Stephens, who's won a major championship, Madison Keys. There are several other young African-American players who've made an impact, as opposed, unfortunately, to Tiger Woods, who, for whatever reason, and remember, Venus Williams' first U.S. Open final was 1997, which was the same year Tiger Woods won his first Masters. And in 22 years later, we see, you know, half a dozen African-American females from the United States, inspired by the Williams sisters, being stars. And we haven't had another African-American star in golf. The only African-American playing the PGA Tour right now, other than Tiger Woods, is Harold Varner, who's a good player and a good guy, but we need more of that. And I hope Coco Gauff becomes a star. I always worry about kids, especially in tennis, who have a lot of success very early, because they're going to be have a lot of money thrown at them. They're going to have a lot of demands put on them. I completely forgot Jennifer Capriati, who, of course, was a teenage phenom, too. And she was an example of someone who had too much thrown at her. She was a French Open semifinalist at 14 And her father was chasing every buck and put all this pressure on her to win. And she ended up leaving the sport for a few years because of all the pressure. And then came back and did win three majors after divorcing herself, really, from her father. And when I see tennis parents in any sport, who are omnipresent with a young player, I get a little bit nervous.
John, a group that has inspired a lot of young women has been the U.S. Women's National Team.
Yep.
They win their second straight World Cup yesterday, 2-0 against the Netherlands. Just overall, what do you think about the impact of this group and how they went in, they dominated, they talked, they celebrated, but they backed it up throughout the entire tournament? I think that it was something to behold from that respect.
Yeah, they're definitely an example of talking the talk and then walking the walk. I mean, Paul knows soccer better than me, but I'm just looking at numbers. That they never trailed in a game. They didn't give up a goal in their three group games. They won 2-0 in the final against what I thought was a very game Netherlands team, and they were clear. You can say they got some calls in the Spain game, but getting good calls and bad calls is part of sports. They got a couple good calls on a day when they weren't very good, and that's part of winning a championship, getting a little bit lucky. But they talk the talk, they walk the walk, and I think, now Paul, you know this better than I think probably this generation was inspired by the 1999 group, and 10, 15, 20 years from now, we'll be talking about girls who were inspired by this group.
Yeah, and Rose Lavelle was kind of one of those, she's going to bridge to the next, she'll probably be the star of the team
right.
In 4 years, and she said, you know, how thrilling it was that I just won a World Cup with people I grew up idolizing. And that's kind
right.
of the way this team is built, that there's always going to be crossover. The thing I was struck by this team, John, is, you know, it was under super pressure to perform. It lived up to that. And in the middle of it, there was still this joyousness that I think I find lacking a lot of times from teams that are under pressure, whether they get it done or not. At any level, we don't see as much international competition outside of the Olympics that has the stakes for a U.S. team anymore, I don't feel like. But there's something to be said for watching a team deliver under pressure with kind of the joy that these women had
yeah.
about it. And they talk yeah. about having fun. They talk about that all the time.
Yeah, and you know, and again, I thought they were over the top with their celebrations in the Thailand game, but look, and I think I said then, if you win the World Cup, celebrate. And they did, and they deserved it, every bit of it. And, you know, you're right. I think the greatest pressure in sports is when you're put in a position where if you win, everybody says, well, you were supposed to win. If you don't win, it's a shocking upset. It's sort of like the Soviet hockey team in 1980. And there have been other examples through the years. I mean, this year's Duke basketball team. Once they beat Kentucky 118-84, unless they won the national championship, they were going to be deemed a failure. I thought that was a team that had a lot of frailty to it, and I wasn't at all shocked when they lost to Michigan State in the Elite Eight. And I don't think they were the best team. I think Virginia was the best team, and they deserved to win the championship. But it happens, and the U.S., this soccer team was put in that position. Win or you're a bust, and they won.
John, Alex Morgan, I'm summing up what she said, but basically said that men celebrate in all sorts of ways, but when I'm sipping tea as a woman, people have a problem with it because, in essence, people don't like to watch women celebrate in sports. Do you buy that, or do you think that as a sporting culture, we criticize people often for
yeah.
different celebrations?
Yeah, I don't buy that. I mean, that to me, that's sort of a cop-out. I mean, I didn't have a big problem with her sipping the tea. I mean, you know, people celebrate in different ways. Well, who's the English player who does the goggles thing, Paul? And had her.
Is it Lucy Bronze?
Yeah, I don't have a big problem with it. But the fact is that we do criticize people, men and women, for over celebrating. Or the thing that I don't like is when it gets to the point where you're taunting. And I think some people saw the sipping of the tea as taunting the English. You know, I don't really think so. I didn't think it was a big deal. But when you get, and you know, I think I said this to you guys last week or a week ago, you know what I hate more in sports than anything is the guy who dunks or, you know, scores a touchdown, you know, makes a great catch, whatever, and starts pounding his chest. Look at me. Look at me. I did it. Especially in team sports. You know, somebody threw you that football. Somebody threw you a pass for the dunk, whatever. Team sports is supposed to be about more than just you. I wasn't thrilled the other day. I didn't watch it live because I wouldn't be caught dead watching summer basketball. But I saw a replay of Zion Williamson after a dunk, striking kind of a Superman pose. Did you guys see that?
Yes.
You're playing summer league basketball, pal. Cool it. And I disagree with Alex Morgan and others. She's not the only one. And others saying that, you know, we criticize women in ways we don't criticize men. That may be true in some areas. But not in this one. I mean, I think it's become a part of what we do to kind of call guys and women out when they go over the line. And I didn't think the T thing was over the line, just for the record.
John, NBA Summer League has become like a giant thing. Like, Twitter is all over it. Beat writers are following their teams. This used to be nothing. How is the NBA growing it this way, and how unhealthy is it to have year-round basketball?
The NBA's done an amazing marketing job in general and with this summer league. I can remember when the biggest summer league was the L.A. Summer League, and I actually had an idea to do a book. It was played at Loyola Marymount University out near the LAX airport, to do a book on what it was like to play in this kind of obscurity. To play in front of crowds of, you know, 200-300 people who might pay $2-3, if anything, to get in. I think you might have been able to get in free. I could be wrong about that. And now, you know, the whole thing is in Vegas, and they play in Thomas and Mack Arena, which seats 17,500 people. I think they had a sellout there on Friday night when the Pelicans played with Zion Williamson, and people were scalping tickets at ridiculous amounts of money to see what's barely an exhibition game. ESPN seems to televise every single game. If they don't, NBA TV picks up the other ones. And it used to be the first-round draft picks never played in this league, never played in the summer. It was a league for guys looking for jobs, period. And now you've got first-round draft picks playing. The number one pick in the draft was there on Friday night. Now, he's not going to play the rest of the time because he had a knee, bumped a knee, and that's a smart move, in my opinion, by the Pelicans. I would never put a prize player into summer league basketball. Why? You know, why? But you're right, Paul. It's become a big deal, and beat writers cover it. There was a 25-inch story in the Washington Post this morning by the Wizards beat writer Candace Buckner on Hayat Shimura's first game as a Wizard, and what was good and what wasn't as good. It's freaking July, boys and girls. And yet, you know, every move is being covered by television, by print guys. It's amazing. It really is amazing. It's almost as amazing as MLB and ESPN being able to convince people that the home run derby is something more than glorified batting practice. That's amazing, too.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that here momentarily, John. But first, on the summer league and the interest, I think part of it is you have LeBron James and Anthony Davis and guys like that showing up sitting courtside.
Yep.
And the ability to get the reaction shot of them with all this crazy free agency happening, like you had the other night with what went on with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George and the Clippers. How about the Los Angeles Clippers, of all organizations, playing chess when everyone else was playing checkers? But, John, they had to leverage their entire future to do so. They traded away 4 first-round draft picks and 2 protected first-round draft picks to get Paul George. But in return, they get a team that's relevant right away with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George.
Yeah, in a different way, ironically enough, given that Kawhi Leonard's involved, they did what the Raptors did a year ago when they traded to get Kawhi Leonard, knowing that he was going to be a free agent after 1 year. And they said, okay, if we only have him for 1 year, maybe we'll win a championship. And they did. Clearly, the Clippers' window isn't going to be that broad because they're going to lack draft picks going forward. But for now, they've got, I think, 2 of the 5 best players in the league. That doesn't mean they're going to win. You need more than superstars. It's important how you fill in the rest of your roster and whether the guys you fill in with or have already can play with those two superstars. But definitely an incredibly bold move. Clearly, getting Donald Sterling out has turned the Clippers from one of the more laughable franchises in sports into a very real and serious contender franchise, especially with Doc Rivers coaching him, because Doc knows how to win.
John, do you think this is improvement in terms of the way the NBA is set up from a championship perspective when you look at the teams that have a chance now with the Nets and Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, the Clippers, the Lakers, and the fact the Warriors are taking a bit of a backseat this upcoming year?
Well, you know, it's funny because the Warriors, nobody saw the Warriors dynasty coming, five straight finals, three titles. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody knew how good Steph Curry was when they drafted him with the seventh pick in the draft, not with the first pick. It wasn't like a Zion Williamson situation. Draymond Green was a second-round pick. Nobody knew how good Klay Thompson was, and they picked the right coach at the right time in Steve Kerr. So I think that it certainly with Durant leaving the Warriors, he wouldn't have played next year anyway. With Klay Thompson being a question mark for next season, the Warriors clearly are going to come back to the pack and maybe fall into the pack, and you have a bunch of new possibilities coming along to win the championship, and I think that's a good thing. The only thing I would disagree with you on a little bit, Chad, is the notion that the Nets are now a contender. Durant's not going to play next year. He'll be 32 by the time he does come back and play. We don't know how good a player he'll be after the Achilles surgery. I think Kyrie Irving is as likely to make a team nosedive as he is likely to make them champions, because he's completely out of his mind.
My son and his baseball team are playing in a Cal Ripken tournament in Fredericksburg, Virginia, starting a week from tomorrow. Three families are coming up early to tour D.C. a little bit starting on Saturday. Nationals out of town, sadly. We're going to hop a train or pile into a couple cars and go to Camden Yards on Sunday. Is this crazy behavior?
Not at all. I mean, have you ever been to Camden Yards?
Oh, yeah. I've been a bunch of times, but the kids have.
I mean, even though the Orioles are terrible, the experience of being in that ballpark makes it worthwhile. I love being in Camden Yards. I still go to games up there whenever I can, even though the Orioles have been bad the last couple of years. The opponent can make it worthwhile. Orioles are playing a little better. They did just win 2 out of 3 against the Blue Jays, which was they had their first chance to sweep a series all season yesterday and, of course, didn't do it. But, no, that's not crazy behavior at all. I would 100% urge you to do it. In fact, before you said what you were going to say, what you said about the Nats being out of town, I was going to say, well, go see the Orioles.
Yeah. So, kids run the bases on Sunday, too.
Even better. Even better. You know, the Camden Yards experience is never a bad one. It was the first of the new ballparks, the modern ballpark, so-called, and it's now in its, let me do the math, 28th season. God, that makes me feel
old.
Wow,
that makes me feel old,
too. And it's still great.
So, John, we know how you feel about the Home Run Derby, and I'm right there with you. Normally, I have no interest, but I am curious because I'm a Braves fan. Ronald Acuna is in the Home Run Derby. I'm going to watch tonight. Because Ronald Acuna is in the Home Run Derby. Mm-hmm. Are there fans of individual teams? Is that what drives anyone to watch this? Is that you're a fan of a certain player? Let's say you like Jock Peterson and you're a Dodgers fan, so Dodgers fans tune in. I'm trying to find the appeal anywhere I can in this event, and the only reason I'm watching is for Acuna. Are there other fans like me?
I'm assuming that there must be, Chad, because people do watch it on TV. The stadium will probably be sold out tonight for this thing. And, you know, MLB and ESPN have been able to sell it as, quote, an event, you know, something you want to be part of in some way. But Pete Alonso is in the Home Run Derby tonight. He's got 30 home runs. He's having an amazing rookie year for the Mets. You guys know I'm a Mets fan. I have no intention of watching. The only thing I care about is that Pete Alonso doesn't mess up his swing tonight. Because guys have messed up their swing being in the Derby, because you have to swing for a home run on every pitch. But no, I won't be watching. I think there's a good Seinfeld rerun on tonight that I'll watch. But I see what you're saying, Chad. And look, to each his own. I would never tell somebody to not watch the Home Run Derby if they want to. I just have absolutely zero interest in it. I was there, I think I was there, I believe this, that the day the Home Run Derby was created. It was 1984. I was covering the All-Star Game in San Francisco. And on Monday afternoon, the players from the American League and National League just got into this informal, you know, home run hitting contest. It wasn't planned. The stadium wasn't full. They didn't sell tickets. You could just walk in on Monday in those days. And it became fun, you know, with the Giants fans cheering for the National League players, and there were A's fans there cheering for the American League players. And it was informal. It was not a big deal. It wasn't on television, and it was cool. But somebody in baseball said, you know what, we could formalize this and make money. And that's what they've done.
So, John, I'm asking you this as someone who's out on soccer. And I want you to give me your opinion as someone who's out on soccer. U.S. women yesterday, they win the World Cup. Big opportunity for the men last night to win the Gold Cup on the same day the women win the World Cup. They lose to Mexico. How big of an opportunity lost is that for the indifferent sports fan out there that maybe tuned in to watch the U.S. team last night simply because they were driven with patriotism after the American women won that day and they wanted to see the men top it off? And them losing, how much did that hurt that indifferent sports fan out there like yourself when it comes to soccer?
I'm going to say not that much, Chad, because, yeah, there might have been some people who, it was 9 o'clock at night before the game started. There might have been some people who said, oh, yeah, the American women won. Let's see if the American men can win, too. But, Paul, you know this better than me. The indifferent soccer fan to use, or indifferent fan to use Chad's term, doesn't have any idea what the CONCACAF World Cup is. Don't have any idea what it is. Gold Cup, excuse me. See, I didn't even say it right. When the U.S. is qualifying for the World Cup, the men, that will be an opportunity for them to maybe build on what the women have done by saying, look, the women won the World Cup. We at least want to qualify this time around, which the American men didn't do in 2018. But I think, let me put it this way, Chad. If the American men had won that game against Mexico, they won the Gold Cup last time around. I don't think you would have seen a big boost in popularity for men's soccer. I think soccer, you know, now women's soccer is going to have a blip here the way it did after 1999 because the American women won. And when the American men got to the World Cup semis, what year was that, Paul? Was that 2010? Not quarters, I mean.
Quarters.
They made it to quarters.
No, I think 2002 when they beat Mexico.
But I thought they made the quarters again in South Africa.
No,
maybe
they.
But when
they lost in the knockout round.
They lost to Ghana.
Something in the World Cup. You know, there's a blip, a little bit of a few more fans coming in. But it's soccer is like hockey. It's a niche sport. The fans who love it with a capital L. But you're not going to ever, in this country, get soccer to the same level as basketball, baseball, or football. It's just not going to happen.
John Feinstein with the Washington Post joins us every Monday. John, thanks as always.
My pleasure, guys. Talk to you next week.